Okay, good morning, everyone. I think we'll make a start. So this is week three of our series, Talk, Connect, and Inspire, based in part on the works of Judith Glaser in her book, Conversational Intelligence. First of all, I just want to mention that today's shiur is sponsored by Rita in honor of the yard site of her mother, which takes place this Sunday on the 20th of Iyar. So wish the neshama shav and aliyah, and I wish the whole family only good things, and asach brocha and mazel. Also, before I start, I wanted to mention we have a number of things leading up to the festival of Shavuot. I want to mention in particular, next week we have a shiur at Shelley's house, which starts at 7:30. It's 105 Kings Road. And it's an interesting topic. You'll see the significance of it when you come, hopefully. This topic is, are we still in the shtetl? Why is Orthodox so rigid, or is it? That's Thursday, next Thursday night at 7:30, men and women. As well as the two-week Kabbalah series, which is starting this Monday night at my home, at 7:45, also for men and women, this Monday night. Okay. So, let's begin just with a little bit of a review, as we always do. We talked about last week that the direction of a conversation has much more to do with the style of the conversation than the content, and the way we begin it, and the way it's structured, and so on. And we discussed the concept that trust turns out to be the key descriptor of a good conversation. Do we trust each other? Do we feel like two people on the same team with common goals, trying to understand and explore each other's interests and understanding, or is it sort of two opposite competing teams? Does everyone in the conversation feel safe, and so on? We talked about that's why in Kabbalah we have this concept of kiruv chitzoni, the general coming together to be close before the actual closeness, like the badekin or the joke in the beginning of the class and so on. So we discussed that trust, by definition, is not that the other person is perfect. I don't trust the other person because they're perfect. They're not perfect, but I trust them because I can still learn from them, I can understand them, and there's what to gain from the other person, right? And we ended off with the good news is that trust can be built, even if you're not sure if the other person trusts us, because the wisdom of King Solomon is that kamayim hapanim el panim, it's a mirror, the way I look into the water, that's how my reflection looks back at me, and therefore the more I value and trust and lift up other people, the more likely it is to come back. So I want to do two things today. First, I want to just follow up on that a little bit and then go to another part, sort of the next part of this discussion. I want to make just a small comment on the concept of rebuilding trust once trust is broken, right? And the short answer is that if trust is already broken, we can still rebuild it. It's not easy, but it can be done. So I was reflecting on it this week, and everything happens not by chance, and it came into the discussion how we are sort of discussing this concept, because I had a discussion with a parent this week. Called me, actually not from Sydney, but called me for some advice, parenting advice. And essentially they were getting into a whole conflict with their child, which I'll come to a little bit later. And I sort of gave him a bit of tips on how I should approach the conversation and approach the whole idea. But he said, but there's already a bad feeling. We're already in conflict. We're already two opposite teams. We don't feel safe with each other already. So how am I going to rebuild that? And Judith Glaser in her book actually talks about this a little bit. And she talks about building trust and rebuilding trust. And she talks about five things, which I'm going to come back to in a few minutes. She talks about an acronym of trust. She says transparency, relationship, understanding, shared success, and truth. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, the reason that I thought of this is because I thought back to a story that happened with me a long, long time ago when I was in education in high school. So I reflected on this encounter that I had with a student, which I'll share with you. Now remember, I only tell you stories that worked, okay? So so this one happened to work. I was never perfect, I still am not perfect. I make plenty of mistakes, like all of us. So this one happened to be a good one, so I'm sharing it with you. Okay. So I had a student who was a nightmare, an honest nightmare. A student had ADHD, the student was just oppositional. It came into year 7, I was in high school, had a bad reputation in primary school, it was off the wall. And he was in a class of mine, a small class, and we were just going at each other initially, right? And I just didn't know what I was going to do. And I really was determined. I was absolutely determined. Maybe it was in the height of my educational sort of passion, and I was studying these things, and I was determined to reach him. And in general, when I studied sort of concepts to do with learning difficulties and differentiation in the classroom and sort of how you reach individual students, I was absolutely determined, I'm going to turn this around. But it was getting to a point, I don't know what to do, because we were in conflict, right? He was truly off the wall. I mean, it was a challenge. Like, you know, he would disturb other people in class all the time. He never even realized what he was doing half the time. He was like all over the place. But I was sure there must be a way to reach him. So I took the lead. I decided it's up to me, first of all, to break the cycle. And that's an important thing for starters, because when there's a gridlock, I've forgotten the name of the author, but there's a famous book called The Dance of Anger. I've forgotten who wrote it, but she talks about how when people in relationships get angry with each other, same thing. So I get angry with you get angry with me, then I get more angry with you, and this comes like this dance, and we keep getting angry with each other until someone breaks the circuit, right? And in a relationship, often if you want to build trust or rebuild trust, you've got to break the cycle. And particularly when it's a hierarchical relationship, whether it's a teacher and a student or whatever, or a parent and a child. So I wanted to break the cycle, which you have to do. You have to sort of break that circuit, kind of clear the air, make space, and start again, and work on the relationship. Now, at that time, I hadn't read this book, and I sort of didn't know this formula, but I kind of, looking back, did what sort of the formula suggests. So the first thing she talks about is transparency. So I'm going to tell you what I did. And I was very transparent. I called the student into my office, and I said, listen, let's be very, very truthful. I said, at the moment, I don't like you and you don't like me. And like he was taken aback. He wasn't, you know, he never knew that a sort of principal would talk to him like that. Like would acknowledge that he didn't like me. But that was the truth. We were not liking each other at that point. And I said, let's break this. I said, look, I understand. You don't like me. I don't like you at the moment. Meaning I don't like the way you're behaving. I don't like what you're doing to me. I don't like what you're doing to the other kids. And I also said to him, I'm going to be absolutely honest with you. I understand that there's a conflict. Now, this is an important thing, by the way. This is so important, very hard to do normally, but thank God I did it then. I said, I understand there's a conflict. And I said to him, that part of that conflict is my fault. Because I overreact. I said, you push my buttons, and then I overreact, and I say things I shouldn't say. I scream at you, and I say, I do things I shouldn't do. And I need to apologize for that, which, you know, that's a great circuit breaker, because that threw him off completely. The last thing I don't think it ever happened to him before, and the last thing that he expected was the teacher or even the principal to actually apologize to him, right? So I said, I want to apologize to you, and I want to start again, and I want to build a relationship, right? And then I went to the next stage, which is relationship. I said, look, I don't like what's happening now, because I really value you. I think you have amazing potential. I really want to have a healthy relationship with you. You're my students. I'm your teacher. To be honest, we're stuck with each other for a while. So let's make this work. And I said, I really want to build this relationship. And I told him that I think we have a lot to gain from each other. Right? So it was reciprocal. I said, I think I have a lot to gain from you. You have a lot to gain with me. But it's not going to happen the way it is now. So we need to change it. Right? I don't remember the exact words I said, but it was a long time ago. But this is sort of the thing, right? And then I went to the next thing which she talks about, which is understanding. So I said, look, the first thing is we need to really understand each other. Right? You need to understand where I'm coming from, I understand where you're coming from. And we talked about things like I needed him to understand that when he makes a noise in the middle of the classroom, other people can't learn. I was pretty flexible as a teacher, but I had a few no-nos. And one of the no-nos, as we know in every classroom, is that you have to be responsible. You have to let other people learn. You cannot undermine the opportunity for other people to be successful and learn, even if you're tuning out, but you can't disturb other people from learning. So I needed to be very clear about that. But I also needed to understand him, and I said, let's understand how hard, maybe I'm not understanding how hard it is for you. It's hard for you to concentrate, it's hard for you to sit in one place for a long time, it's hard for you, the subject matter maybe you're not used to, and so on and so forth. So we had a lot of conversation, me trying to get him to understand my problem, I trying to understand where he was coming from and so on. And then I talked about shared success. I actually did talk about this, and she says in the book, shared success. I said, I want you to understand one thing. I said, I'm not going away. And you're not going away. And the reason for that is, I said, because I have a responsibility. So my responsibility is that you need to learn. You need to be successful in learning, right? And I'm responsible for your education, which means my success is if every student in the class learns. Your success is if you succeed. In other words, if you grow and you gain knowledge that you didn't know till now, you'll succeed, right? So therefore, let's be truthful with each other and let's work out and let's negotiate something. I went to sort of that last thing, the truth. In other words, what's going to work? What's going to work to break the circle? What's going to work with each other? What do we both need? What can we negotiate on? What are the red lines? Part of this, what she talks about in the book, is showing empathy. So like, again, with the understanding, what's the way forward? I said, let's negotiate something forward, but let's remember that we're both on the negotiating team, so you don't get to call all the shots. You can tell me what you need. I'll tell you what I need. Let's work it through together. And I worked out for this kid a system like I've never worked out for any kid in the ever. And I taught for a number of years, right? I had systems going on and incentive programs and little opportunities for him because he really needed this. He could, if he was feeling uptight and he was going to explode, he was able to go out for a break a little bit. I made sure to send him a couple errands here and there. I had a differentiated curriculum for him where he only was responsible for part of the work, but he wasn't allowed to disturb anyone else, and so on and so forth. I'll tell you the end of the story because it was a good ending and it's a story that worked, as I said, that's what I'm sharing with you, right? I was teaching him Talmud, and it was a very, very complex subject, and twice a year we'd have the final exam, which is obviously you do in many schools, right? So I decided this kid is not, it's not possible for him to write an exam. Like, exam is not going to work for him. So I called him over. I said it to the whole class, actually, but I called him over particularly, and I said, I want to give you guys a challenge. And I really didn't care. I'm not such a believer in keeping to the structures of the rules of the way people do things. If it works, it works. So I said to them, listen, there's an exam coming up in a few weeks. We've covered, let's say, I don't know, it was 4 pages of the Talmud, very complex pages. You're responsible for it. You need to know it. There's a choice. You can either study for the exam and work really hard and sit a normal formal exam, or you can go away and learn the entire content of what we learned the last 6 months by heart, meaning not word for word in Aramaic, but you need to be able to tell me the whole flow. And you should know that the Talmud flow is very complex. It's question, answer, complicated analysis. If you can do that and come and share it with me, I'll set aside a recess. You come and share it with me, I'll test you, and I'll give you 100. You don't have to sit the exam. We should read the same thing, but it doesn't matter, right? So this kid thought it was really cute. He hated exams. I used to see him in recess walking up and down with his papers, studying and concentrating. And he came to me, he said the whole thing, balpe, as we say in Hebrew, bahart, and I gave him 100, and his parents were happy, he was happy, and he was fine, right? I'm not sure it's exactly according to the rules, but no, the good end of the story there today is a very successful person. He's actually a very successful Torah scholar, right? And that's where he wanted to go, that's where his family wanted him to go. Became a rabbi, he's married, he's got a family, and it's amazing, right? But what I learned from that, while I'm telling you this story, is that you can repair a broken trust. You can. Because I've often had this discussion with parents and teachers where they think, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but it's too late, right? Or a teacher will say, I mean, how am I going to be able to come into the classroom and face them again when I've messed up so many times? Every day is a new day. Every experience is a new experience, right? You just need to be able to break that circuit and to go through this process. And I told that parent the same thing the other day. It was a problem he was having with a child. He described to me the problem of late coming, getting up late, whatever the cause was. And it was very, very apparent from the conversation. I'm not a therapist and I don't make a diagnosis, but it was very, very clear that it wasn't a rebellious thing. It's the child is a real problem. I gave him some guidance of what type of help to seek. And I said, the first thing you need to do is you need to actually go to your child and say, listen, we're having this problem. We need to work on it. I've been getting upset. I've been screaming at you. I apologize. I'm not going to do that anymore. Because it wasn't working. It wasn't working because the child can't help it. He needs assistance, right? So I said, you need to say, look, I understand you've got a problem. We need to fix it. I'm not leaving it this way. We're going to work together. And we're going to ensure that this problem is remedied. But I need to apologize for screaming at you because that was wrong, and I'm still the father, I'm still going to call the shots, I'm still going to lead, but let's start again, and it will work. I'm sure it'll work. He hasn't got back to me yet, but I'm sure it'll work. Which ties into an interesting thing. Just a few days ago, we had a minor festival called Pesach Sheni. I don't know if you're aware of that concept. It's the second Pesach. Nothing to be afraid of. It's not like the big Pesach. But Pesach Sheni is the second chance. It goes back to the time of the temple where a key feature of the Pesach festival was to bring the paschal lamb, right? Today we have on the Seder plate the shank bone. To commemorate that, was to bring the paschal lamb. But a person, in order to bring that paschal lamb, needed to be pure, needed to be in the temple, not far away. And it goes back to the story in the desert, when the Jewish people were in the desert, where with the group of people who couldn't bring the paschal lamb because they had come into contact with a dead body and they were therefore impure, needed to go through a purification process. And the time for the paschal lamb came. It was Erev Pesach. And they came to Moses and they're saying, why should we lose out? We can't bring the carbon Pesach. Right? So God Moshe Rabbeinu consults God, and God gives this mitzvah called Pesach Sheni. That whoever couldn't bring the first Pesach for whatever reason, a month later on the 14th of Iyar, which is a few days ago, you're able to go again to the temple. This time you don't have to clean your house and get rid of all the chametz, but you can bring a second Pesach. You can bring the paschal lamb, eat it on the night, just as they would do in the first Pesach, with matzah and maror, but you have the experience again, right? And therefore, the commentaries explain that this mitzvah is not just about the Pesach, but it's a general concept. The concept is that no matter how far gone a person has lost their way in anything, there's always a second chance. Always a second chance. Okay. Now, you know, just a little nice story the other day. Because sometimes we don't give people second chances, even though God gives us a second chance, right? And we don't give ourselves a second chance. So there's a rabbi, I mentioned this before, there's a rabbi, and I might mention him at the end if we have time, we'll see. There's a rabbi who tells stories, and they're beautiful stories. I've shared one with you before. His name is Rabbi Yoel Gold. So he tells a story that he was witness to, of a school in California who was running a dinner. And they wanted to bring out for entertainment for the dinner a very famous, well-known violinist from Israel. A religious guy who plays the violin very, very beautifully, and they brought him out. So he arrives in California at the airport. His host picks him up. He has his suitcase and his violin in a case. He goes to the person's house. They want to just kind of fresh up a little bit. He takes out his suitcase, leaves his violin in the car because he's going to the dinner anyway. He needs the violin. And they go inside. They freshen up. There's something to eat. They go back into the car, off to the dinner, which is about a couple of hours away, hour and a half away. Comes to the dinner, goes to the car, opens up the car, and the violin is not there. He thinks to himself, now, where's the violin? What happened? He didn't recognize the cars. The guy picked up the violinist in his wife's car and then took him with his own car. And he didn't realize that switched cars. The only problem is that his wife's car, for some reason, he still had the keys. The husband still had the keys. And he was at the dinner and the wife was at home. And it was impossible. If he would drive back and then... It's fafal, as they say. It's not going to happen. And this guy thinks to himself, I'm so embarrassed. My career's over. Imagine what people are going to say. They brought me out especially from Israel. And there was no show. Bottom line, there was no show. Goes back to Israel, really upset. Anyway, and he thinks, anyway, a while goes by, almost a year, suddenly there's a phone call. Who's the phone call? The guy who organized the dinner. You can see it on the... He's going to see. So he thinks to himself, Oy vey, what does this guy want from me? I don't know. Does he want a lawsuit against me? Does he want to sue me? Does he want to charge me for the expenses of the dinner? Calls up, he says, oh, how are you? Remember me? He says, yeah, I do. Yeah. do I remember? Right? And he says, I'm really sorry. I apologize again. What do you want? He says, look, we're doing another dinner in a month. You want to come? He says, I'll pay you to come just to fix up. What do I want? He says, but why are you... like? He says, no, look, you made a mistake last year. It was a bad mistake. But you're still apparently a very good violinist, and people really wanted to hear you, and we'll give you, come out. And he went, right? And I was listening to the story, and I think to myself, actually, it's a great story on both ends, because I think that there's a greatness in both of these people. I mean, first of all, organizing the dinner, it's a real greatness to recognize a mistake was a mistake, but the guy's a good guy. Let's give him a second chance, right? I don't know how many people do that, but it was... it was pretty amazing. I think it's also greatness that he went and he fronted up and he wasn't embarrassed. I mean, imagine showing, I mean, I'm sure at least 70% of the crowd would be the same people, right? When people make fundraising dinners, it's more or less the same people, a bit of turnover and overlap, but same people. For him to come back and to say, well, I'm going to do it right this time, but I'm here, it's also pretty good. Because I think we have to give other people a second chance, but part of giving other people a second chance is giving ourselves a second chance. Okay. So that's about trust and about rebuilding trust. However, following on from that, there are other things in a conversation that create a good conversation and are important. And there's something which Judith Glasser in her book calls rituals, conversational rituals. All right. I'll just read you a little paragraph. She says, I've come to treasure the insight that conversational rituals we embed into our culture and our relationships, and which give us a way to successfully structure our engagements with others. As an organizational anthropologist, I have been a student of conversational rituals my whole life, whether in some parts of the world it's bowing slightly to someone when greeting them or passing someone to someone. What she's saying is that, again, it's not the content. There are certain things, certain actions, certain rituals, and we'll see why this is so important, that we do or say or engage in when we're having conversations, which become incredibly important to make them good conversations. Why is that? First of all, as we said before, as we said last week, the style of conversation is particularly important. You know, the Talmud says, and the Rambam quotes this a lot, and he talks about the conduct of wise people, right? Wise people as distinct from clever people, right? There are clever people who know lots of facts and absorb lots of information, but are not wise. They're not wise in their relationships, not wise in how they interact with other people, and so on. So the Rambam says, and he quotes from the Talmud, I'll say it in Hebrew and then translate it, Divrei Chachamim Benachat Nishma'im. Since the words of the wise are always heard calmly, right? Calmly. The calmness in a conversation is very important. Now, why is that such a simple thing? Right? Why is it hard? Because when you want to bring over a point to someone else, particularly if you're passionate about your point of view, we often tend not to do it calmly. Right? We always like subconsciously say to like, you don't understand what I'm saying, but like, and we start shooting, right? And we're not calm. And we know, and now there's evidence, the scientific evidence to prove this, that generally when you're not calm in a conversation, the other person doesn't actually hear what you're saying. I've said this before, it's particularly when it's a debate. In other words, particularly when you're trying to inspire someone and guide someone or instruct someone. Not so much when you're explaining something or you're teaching something. There's a big difference. Teaching, sometimes passion is good. And people get involved and they scream and they bring for a point. That's okay. Because that's helpful in that conversation. Because sometimes the passion of the idea comes across and people are more engaged in the topic, in the academic topic. But that's a different type of conversation. But when you're trying to show someone or help someone change or support someone, the words of the wise are heard with calmness. Right? But it's not just that. It's also about different things we do during a conversation, which she calls rituals. Because rituals often create space and make a conversation that much deeper and make a conversation into a connection rather than a match. Why is this? Because, you know, we said last week, we quoted from what she brings in a book, that generally speaking, people are addicted to being right. Correct? Why are we addicted to being right? Why is that, right? So I want to just revisit something we've spoken about many times before we go into these conversational rituals. And it has a lot to do with the time of year we're in, which we haven't spoken about much this year, but it really is a very important time of the year. It's the time of the Omer, right? And the time of the Omer traditionally is known as a time of personal growth. God gives us the festival of Pesach. He took the Jews out of Egypt. He sent them into the desert. They traveled for 7 weeks. They arrived at Mount Sinai. At the end of the journey, they got the Torah on the 50th day, right? So there was this concept of counting down, and we have the 7 weeks of the Omer to count down. But we are taught that it's not just a memory to commemorate them counting down towards the giving of the Torah, but we count every year in our own personal experience. Why? Because God took us out of Egypt, but He needed us to embark and engage in a process of refinement, of self-growth, of self-development, before we were ready to receive the Torah, right? Why? So the way it works is, there's a whole formula. The way this time of the year works is as follows, and it creates a bit of a model and a formula for how we engage in our own personal growth, including how we relate to others and how we have an impact on others through our conversations and through our speaking. The first day, we start counting the Omer the second day of Pesach. Specifically the second day of Pesach. What happens the first day of Pesach? First day of Pesach is the festival of Pesach. And we eat matzah. Right? That's the mitzvah. The first night of Pesach, we eat matzah. We eat matzah and we are prohibited to have any chametz. Right? After the first day, now God says, now you got to start working on yourself. And I give you 7 weeks. Why 7 weeks? Because as we know, in the 10 powers of the soul, there are 7 emotions, right? Divided in the 6th and the 7th. Chesed, Gevurah, and so on. 7, 6, and then the 7th part of our personality, which all need working on, right? The six or seven emotions is basically the way we respond to the outside world, the way we respond to other people, the way we respond to stimulus, which happens outside of us, right? So we know that the personality... Our consciousness is divided into different layers. Part of that is cognition, the way we think, the way we process intellect. Processing intellect is how we take things from the outside and internalize them inwards. Emotions are inside out, how we respond to the world outside of us. 7 emotional forces, 7 ways of responding to the outside world. Now, how are we supposed to better ourselves? How do we work on these 7 emotions in these 7 weeks? Right? We're currently in the 5th week, by the way, which is the particular attribute called Hod, which we'll leave for another time, but this is the process of these 7 weeks, right? How are we supposed to do it, and why do we need matzah the first day of Pesach before we start? So it all boils down to one thing, that in order to improve our personality, in order to grow, in order to connect to other people, we need to deal with our ego, right? Essentially. Because What drives every failure in our own personality or in our relationships with others, essentially, is ego. Ego is when we lock ourselves into ourselves, and we preserve self-interest, and we do only what works for us and what feels good at the moment, without long-term vision of meaning and purpose. Something we've discussed many times, right? We know, of course, that Pesach, the beginning of the journey, when we left Egypt, the eating of matzah, the getting rid of chametz, is this exact concept of letting go of ego. Because we are taught that chametz, which rises, represents the ego. Whereas matzah, which doesn't rise, represents the selflessness, humility, and so on and so forth. Now, when we say getting rid of ego, it's 4 words that are very easy to say, and we say it very quickly. However, it's a lifelong mission to let go of ego, right? And it's naive to think that we can let go of our ego. What it actually means is we should be conscious of our ego and chip away at it a little bit, right? But the concept, at least in our mind, the mindset, the outlook is we have to let go of our own ego. Because we know we have 2 forces in our subconscious. The ego is one, and the ego is very strong. It drives many of our decisions. It drives many of our interactions, many of our conversations. And we have that soul, which is selfless, that godly spark, which gives us selflessness, lets us let go of our ego, gives us a vision of meaning and purpose, and so on and so forth. So let's develop this just a little bit. What does it mean? What does it mean to work on ourselves? What does it mean? It means 2 things. We've talked about this a lot, so I'm just gonna make it very short. We all have a personality. So in those 7 emotional attributes, we all have one or two that we particularly connect to. So we've talked about this before. Some of us are more chesed people, some of us are more gvura people, and so on and so forth, right? And that's fine. And part of growth means to nurture who we are, to nurture our personality. But to nurture in a way where we can grow within the context of our personality in a positive way. So it's channeling who we are in the right direction. So just to give you an example, chesed, which is love, which is kindness. There's good chesed and bad chesed, right? Good chesed is when we are kind to others, we're compassionate to others, we have empathy for others, we help others. Bad chesed is when we connect to the wrong things. Selfish love, indulgence, all part of chesed, right? Chesed is about connecting, so sometimes we connect to things which are destructive. So there's good chesed and bad. We do it for our own short-term benefit, right? As we know, indulgence, overindulgence in pleasure in the Torah is referred to as chesed. Because also, it's a connection. Just connecting to the wrong things, which are ultimately bad for us, but they're pleasurable for us in the moment, right? So, if our personality is chesed, part of that growth journey is to make sure that the things that we do connect to, the parts of our personality that is us, that is who we are more selfless than selfish. Is that clear? Okay. That's part one. Which means sometimes we have to delay our instant gratification, we have to make decisions to have self-control, stand back from certain things which are bad for us, engage in that type of chesed which is more beneficial, more meaningful, and purposeful. It takes a lot of work. And then we know, of course, and something we've talked about millions of times, that the other part of growth is embracing those parts of our personality that we are not disposed to. Understanding that if we chesed people, we also have to engage in gevurah once in a while. If we gevurah people, we need chesed because we need all of them. That's the truth, right? So part of that growth is engaging in the part of the emotional traits or those personality character traits that are not us. In other words, it's going beyond ourselves, freeing ourselves from ourselves, becoming even those things that we think we aren't, because it's beneficial for us, right? So it's two distinct parts of how we grow. The point is, however, that those two distinct parts of growth are all based on one thing, letting go of ego. Because if we remain trapped in ourselves, we can't do either of those things. If we remain trapped in ourselves, then we do what we think is good for ourselves. In the moment. What is self-protective and self-preserving in the moment. So, no, it won't be good chesed, it'll be bad chesed. And if we're trapped in ourselves, we certainly can't engage in gevura, because gevura is not us. When you egocentric, then you only remain in who you are. Well, I'm not gevura, it doesn't talk to me, I'm not comfortable with it, it's hard for me. So I don't go there. Because I'm trapped in me. And I'm trapped in me that even the parts that are me, I'm only going to do what's right for me now. Or what I think is right for me now. Both parts of growth is only when we let go of ego a little bit. Because that means I'm prepared to have self-control. I'm prepared to put myself to a side for a greater vision, for a long-term benefit. Because I'm surrendering to someone else or something else that can guide me and say, no, what you think is good for you now isn't good for you now. It's not good for your long-term vision, not good for your long-term experience, not good for your long-term meaning and purpose. And also, if I let go of the ego, I'm prepared to go beyond myself. I'm prepared to do things that are hard for me. I'm prepared to do things that are not characteristic of who I am. I'm prepared to let go of my natural dispositions and do other things. Right? So therefore, the formula works like this. God says, listen, you have seven emotional traits. You got to work on them. Those ones that you naturally connect to, you also have to work on to channel them in a more selfless, meaningful way. Those ones you don't naturally connect to, you got to learn to connect to. But before you, and that's why I give you 7 weeks each week to work on another trait. But before you can start, you have to have a day of Pesach. You have to eat matzah. Before you can start, you have to surrender. You have to be willing to give up ego, which most of us find very, very difficult. But, as I said, and I say we find it very difficult because we know that we're not going to give up our ego completely, but we don't have to. Or, I shouldn't say we don't have to, we can't. That's hard, right? What we can do is, and I've said this before, one of the greatest beginnings of giving up our ego is to be aware that we have an ego. Be aware that sometimes the way we respond and sometimes the way we behave is not coming from our soul, but it's coming from our ego. Just to be aware of that. Right? So to be aware that sometimes when we feel threatened by someone and we come up with all sorts of rationalizations why the other person is evil, it's not because they're evil, it's because I feel threatened and insecure because I have an ego. Right? Now, I might not be able to do anything about it. I might still feel threatened because I still have an ego. But at least I know why. I know where it's coming from. The worst thing, and this is true not only in conversations, the worst thing for general growth, the worst thing is when people act guided by their ego and refuse to admit it. And they give you all of these rationalizations why they are completely right and the other person is completely wrong. And I've seen this happen on all levels. I've seen this happen, it happens to all of us, but you're witnessing happening, it's easy to see it with someone else, right? So you see it happening when people give you all sorts of lofty and spiritual rationalizations. Why no, it's got to be like this because they've talked themselves into it. This is the will of God. When you start fighting for the will of God, it's very dangerous. Now, don't take that wrongly. We should all fight for the will of God. But when we're not honest with ourselves, and sometimes we want to do things which are hurtful to other people or are not effective, and we still keep fighting because we talk ourselves into it, that's the will of God, and it's actually not the will of God, it's just our own ego. That's the biggest problem. We have a much bigger fighting chance of growing and making some inroads and making some progress and having some impact when we realize what we're doing, when you realize that some of this, I need to be brutally honest with myself, some of it is coming from ego. And even if I can't get rid of all of it, but at least I know where it's coming from. At least I can act differently. I might not be able to feel differently. Maybe I'm still feeling angry, and I'm still feeling threatened, and I'm still feeling right, and I'm still feeling insecure. But at least I can act differently because I know where it's coming from. So we can't transform ourselves, but we can't get rid of the ego instantaneously. It's a lifelong mission, but at least we can act differently. Now, why is that related to our topic? Because when we have conversations, there's a default position, right? Which we always have to be aware of. In other words, not enough just to hear it once and say, okay, I'm going to have effective conversations now, and I'm going to be calm, I'm going to speak properly, I'm going to try to understand the person, I'm going to try to go in a trusting way. The more we get into a conversation, the more passionate we come, there's going to be those things that come into the conversation which trigger our ego, and make us turn the conversation in the wrong direction. Make it into two teams. Make it like we have to constantly be aware of it. And even if we don't feel that way, we have to at least be aware that it's happening and engage in what she calls the rituals, which is very in line with the Jewish thought that I've shared with you many, many times. That knowing what the actions are, knowing what to do, even if we don't feel it, is amazing because we have this principle which I've shared with you many times, acharei ha-ma'asim nimshach ha-levavot, that the heart follows the actions. If I act selfless at least, I might make a dent. I might actually feel selfless and build real trust and have a real effective conversation. Even if I'm not quite there yet in my heart. But it's about knowing that when you engage in a conversation, an important conversation, and a difficult conversation, and maybe a sensitive conversation, knowing that I need to be aware, not let my ego get in the way, even if I can't get rid of it, but at least know it's there and it could be challenging me at any time. So I'll just talk about two things that she talks about. One of the things is an interesting concept, and that is learning how to ask questions in a conversation. Right? But it's got to be real questions. And she writes like this. I'll just read it. She says she was once went into a whole. She once had a client, and she was doing working with a very, very big team, who was trying to work out ways to have conversations, and protect themselves from very, very big competitors. Right, this was a business model. And she said, I charted their interactions for more than 2 weeks. As they did what I called real plays, that is, recreated their conversation with customers, the patterns of interaction became clear. Listen to this. Over the course of my observations, I saw that 85% of the time, these executives were using statements, and 15% of the time, they were asking questions. And almost all of those questions were statements in disguise. Okay. What I realized is that these sales executives had become bound by conversational rituals that were not serving them well, and they were not alone. And then later she says, "What we create when we create conversational rituals that enable us to honor and respect others, and respect others' views of the world, especially when these views are different from ours, we create space for better conversations, for new ideas to emerge." Right? And when I read that, I was thinking of an interesting thing. Just a few, again, going back to Pesach, right? The mitzvah of Pesach is telling a story. It's educating the next generation. It's having a conversation. What is the entire night of the Seder based on? Questions. Right? In fact, the mitzvah of telling the story is only a mitzvah on a Pesach night. It's one of the mitzvot, eating matzah, eating maror, and so on. One of the mitzvahs is telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt. You don't fulfill the mitzvah if you don't say it in response to a question. That's why you have to have the manishtana first. Right? Because a good conversation has questions. Because questions create space to learn. Questions create curiosity. And we have to facilitate questions. We have to ask questions ourselves and also facilitate questions from others. That's why some of the rituals, some of the conducts of our behaviors that we do on Pesach night, there's no reason for that. You know why we eat a piece of vegetable dipped in a salt water? There is no reason. I mean, there are symbolisms, but there is no reason essentially. Why do we do it? To be strange. To create questions. That's what it says. The model is that the whole Seder is based on the parent-child. A child knows that when you make Kiddush on a Yontif or a Friday night, you go and wash and you eat the meal. Suddenly you made Kiddush and now you're eating vegetables dipped in water. Child says, what's going on here? Right? So the whole custom came to create questions. And there's a few other things that night that have the same explanation. Right? And then we have the four children. And the four children also ask questions. And some of them are challenging questions. And the last one is called the She'eino Yodea Lishol, the one who doesn't even know how to ask. And we are taught that's a problematic child. So we need to do something. So the Haggadah says, U'She'eino Yodea Lishol, if you don't know how to ask, the one who doesn't know how to ask, At Psachlo, you have to open up for him. You have to train him. You have to get him into it. Right? Create space. Find a way into him somewhere. Because when the conversations have questions, the conversation is going to go well. If it doesn't have conversations, you're going to have to work much harder. When there's no questions, right? So it's interesting that when we have a conversation with people, do we ask questions? And what kind of questions? Are the questions directed in ways where we really want to understand? Want to understand, explore, learn the view of the other people? It might even be a conversation we want to convince them of something, but it doesn't matter. You can't do that unless we understand where they're coming from. Unless we understand the world of the other. So it's an interesting thing when we have conversations, just to reflect, how many questions do we really ask? The truth is that in tough, sensitive conversations or passionate conversations, we probably don't want to ask questions because we're more interested in getting our view across. So I don't know if we use these words, but the content we use is, let me explain to you. But it's not about let me explain to you. Why should you listen? I need to understand you first. I need to make sure that you're curious to want to listen to what I have to say, and vice versa. Questions is a great way. Now, I might feel passionate like, come on, like, I don't need to take this time. Let's get to the point, right? And people do that all the time, you know? I'm going to call him up. I'm going to tell him. 5 minutes, I'm done. I feel good. He never heard a thing. Right? It takes time. It takes effort. It takes self-growth. I might not change my whole feeling in an instant, but if I engage in the ritual of asking questions, I might start to feel a bit interested. I might even feel interested. And the more interested I get to feel in the other person, the more effective I'm going to be. The second thing he talks about is becoming aware of blind spots. I'm going to read this. It's very interesting. This, she says, that any conversation, without, if you don't think about it and if you're not aware of it, there are these blind spots in the conversation where we don't realize that something is happening and we need to become aware. And again, it goes back to what I said before. We don't realize because we're coming from our point of view. It's that subtle ego sometimes. And therefore, we need to be aware, at least be aware of those blind spots, and then try and do something about them. What is it? So he says, the blind spot number one, she says, is an assumption that others see what we see, feel what we feel, and think what we think. Right? It's an assumption that we make. And it's just, because sometimes, and then, you know, you know how we know this is true, because I don't know if you ever have the experience, I'm sure we've all had this experience, of having a conversation with someone and for the life of you, you just can't understand why they don't get it. Like, are they so dumb? I thought this guy was like semi-intelligent, right? You don't see it? So what do? We say it again, louder and stronger. And then we say it a third time, even stronger. And they don't get it. I'm very guilty of this. I'm sure many people are. And what's it based on? It's based on because I'm assuming they're coming from the same premise. That's true. If someone comes from the same premise as I am, then I'll be surprised. They don't get it. The answer is they're not coming from the same premise that I am. They don't see what I see. They don't feel what I feel. They have a different view of what's going on. Right? If we would realize how differently they see the world, it would be completely different. Now again, it's hard for us to see that because it's hard for us to know, consciously or subconsciously, it's hard for us to really know that people look at the world differently than we do. And that's part of what we need to understand, part of the questions we need to ask, part of the listening we need to do, and so on and so forth, right? They're kind of connected all these, but there's five. She talked about five blind spots, right? Blind spot number two is the failure to realize that fear, trust, and distrust changes how we see and interpret reality, and therefore how we talk about it. So, it's about our own confidence, first of all. It's our own not being scared to have the conversation. Sometimes we have conversations and we are scared how the conversation is going. And then we end up becoming more forceful. Like, I really need to get this through, so boom, right? And that's not going to work. Because if I come from a point of fear, it's not going to work. And the same thing with the other person, that's what blind spot number three is. An inability to stand in each other's shoes when we are fearful, upset, characterizes blind spot number three. Because we know that when we listen and we are fearful, we don't hear. So often in conversation, what we do is, we do it by force. When you do it by force, the other person feels uncomfortable. When they feel uncomfortable, they don't listen to what we say. And the conversation is completely ineffective. This is true with parents, true with students, true with teachers, true with anyone. It might be even a subtle fear. It might be just a feeling of discomfort. If we make someone feel uncomfortable when we're talking to them, they don't hear what we're saying. Right? Blind spot number four is the assumption that we remember what others say when we actually remember what we think about what others say. Very different. Again, the assumption that we remember what others say when we actually remember what we think about they said. Right? So in other words, someone tells us something to which we need to respond. What do? I get it, but I want to just explain to you something. Yeah. Right? And in fact, we actually don't get it. We get what we think they're saying, when often we actually don't get what they really say. Right? Which obviously means good listening. It means asking them if I understand correctly, making sure that you actually get them before you bring across your point of view, and so on and so forth. And blind spot number five is the assumption that meaning resides in the speaker when in fact it resides in the listener. That's why in my mind's eye I can see a totally different picture of what you are saying than what your mind sees. In other words, we need to validate other people's perspectives. We need to really not just understand them, but validate them and say, I get it from where you're coming from. This is the way, this is the meaning of what's happening. And then we're able to facilitate and express a different point of view. So these are all blind spots that come up in conversations, but they come up all the time. And the reason I think is because they all have to do with letting go of ourselves a little bit. And we never let go of ourselves once. That's what I'm trying to say. That's what I'm trying to say about ego. We have to do the Omer every single year. We have to constantly, it's a lifelong mission. But at least the mindset we have to build is that we have an ego and we can be stuck in ourselves. And the ego that we have in our subconscious will rear its head all the time. And we always have to be aware of its danger. And we always have to be aware of those blind spots in the conversation and put into the conversation rituals. Even if you don't feel that way yet, if you feel, no, I'd rather just ram this through, but put into actions, actual defined actions, into the conversation, things that will help us do things differently, things that will help us steer the conversation differently. Things like questions, things like repeating back to the person what they said, things like pausing and talking calmly, things like making sure that I understand where the other person is coming from, and then we have a fighting chance that the conversation could actually go somewhere. Now, often, it's a pain in the neck, these things. You often wish, like, why do I have to engage altogether? Why bother, kind of thing, right? I wish I didn't have to have this conversation. So I'm going to tell you a story, and I've got to be honest, a bit of transparency here. The story has very little to do with the topic, but I'm going to tell it to you anyways, because, and I'm going to make a very weak link to the topic at the end. So why am I telling you the story? Because a few days ago, I heard a story. We were listening together at home, myself, my wife, and my daughter. And I thought to myself, this is an amazing story. I wish I could tell it on Thursday morning. But I'm not sure how it comes into the topic. So Bela, my daughter, says to me, so just tell them that you heard a nice story and you want to share it with them. I said, okay, I'll try. So from the same Rabbi Yoel Gold, I told you an amazing story. So because it is a topic we've spoken about many, many times, and I'll say I will weekly link it to the topic as well in a moment. But I just thought I'm going to tell you the story anyway. One thing I like about this guy, this is a rabbi, I think he lives in California. I'm not sure, maybe now he lives in Israel, I'm not sure where he lives. But he's developed this career of telling stories. But what I like about his stories is they researched. When he tells them, they often come with supporting videos of the people who were actually part of the story. And they're true. I mean, they're obviously true. The way you could see, the way he backs them up, they're true. And it's a beautiful story. This is a story of Ashkacha Pratit, something I've spoken about many times, that things don't happen just because they happen. Things happen for a reason. Things happen by divine providence. So this is a story that happened, well, it happened over time, but it happened, he discovered the story, in 2019, where he met a Jew called Menashe Tzvi Winkler, who was 100 at the time. In 2019, he was 100. He was born in 1919. He met him in the States. This Jew was born in Copenhagen, which was the capital of Denmark. And he had grown up, and the whole story, his father actually was a rabbi. His father traveled to America to raise funds for yeshiva, and he died there, unfortunately, when he was young. He didn't have a father. That's another part of the story, which we won't go into now, but he grew up and he learnt in different yeshivas. This boy, his mother sent him away. He learnt in Radin and in Baranovich, and then eventually he made it back to Copenhagen. In 1938 he came back to Copenhagen. His mother didn't want him to go back to Europe, to Poland or Lithuania because the clouds were, it wasn't, things weren't good, which is good. And in 1940 the Nazis walked into Denmark, but for a while. In Denmark, particularly, actually, it was still pretty safe for the Jewish people because there was kind of a protection there. But in 1943, they started deporting Jews and you had to flee. And what they did was, him and his, I think, his siblings and his mother, they and some members of the family, they hired a fisherman to take them to Sweden. Now, this was, I mean, many people have this story. The fishermen would take them across the border. A lot of these fishermen did it for free. There were some really good people. I mean, there were really terrible people, but there were some very good people who just did it because they felt it was the right thing to do. And they risked their lives, I mean, to cross those waters where the Germans were patrolling. So they put them into the boat. This guy's name was Mr. Rasmussen, who he told them, he put them on the ship, he covered them with stuff. It's like a fisherman's ship. He said, "You'll hear me interacting with Germans on the way when patrolling the water. I'm going to act friendly. I'm going to make jokes. But it's all an act. I'll get you across," which he did. This Menashe Tzvi Winkler, at the end, he had nothing on him. He had no money to pay him. Right? He arrived in Sweden, saved his life. But he had on him a kiddush cup, a silver kiddush cup, which had his name. It had Menashe Tzvi Ben Michael Shalom, which was his father's name. Right? It was engraved. And he said to the fisherman, "Take it." And he ran away. And "I have to give you something." So, okay. That was the end of the story. 2019, this is decades later. A few months before, he interviewed this person. I interviewed the family. There's videos of him interviewing the family. His daughter, living with him in America, gets a call from a cousin in Belgium. This is like unbelievable. It's crazy. And she tells the following story. She says she was on the way to work, which she normally always takes a tram, which gets her to work quickly. That day there was construction, so she decided she'll take a bus. She got onto the bus leaves, and she realizes it's the wrong bus. She's not used to taking the bus, so she took the wrong bus. She's beating herself up, she's wasting so much time, she's going to have to wait till she can get off, find the right bus, make her way back, run the right route. And, you know, as we all do when our plans don't work out, we get all really upset, right? She's sitting next to a woman. I guess she must have taken out something, a sidur maybe, to say to Tehillim, I don't know exactly. And this woman says to her, "Do you read Hebrew?" She says, "Yeah." "Can you read this for me?" She takes out of her pocket a kiddush cup. And she said, "There's something written here." So she looks at this cup and it's her uncle's name. Menashe Tzvi Ben Michael Shalom. She says, "Where'd you get this?" And she calls Lakewood. She calls her cousin right away. And she tells the story. What happened? What happened was like this. This cup was given to this guy, Mr. Rasmussen. When he died, his son Dan inherited the cup. Put it on a shelf, didn't do anything about it. And after many, it was on the shelf for like years. Then he thought to himself one day, you know, this cup doesn't belong to me really. He didn't know the story behind it. He doesn't know what it is. But he's kind of figured out it's got Hebrew writing. And he lived in a part of Copenhagen that was no Jews. But he says, you know, he has a friend called Mia. Mia works in a place where there's Jews. Maybe she can find out what it means. So she gave it to this lady who was on the bus. Mia says she took the number. She took the cup and forgot about it. It was on her shelf for a year and a half. Then one day she had to take a driving lesson, and she was giving a driving lesson. The driving lesson was in the Jewish quarter, Jewish section of Copenhagen, of Belgium. And she says, you know what? She'll take the cup. She realized, she remembered, you know, she has a job to do. She's going to take and when she's finished her driving lesson, she's going to find a synagogue. And she's going to go in there. Maybe someone can help her. She gets on the bus. She sees this lady. She looks Jewish. She says, maybe she can read Hebrew. So she asks her, right? So anyway, they're all connected. This lady, this Dan, this old man, Mr. Winkler, all the family connected. They were interviewed and stuff like that. Anyway, and Dan said, this is not my cup. First of all, he said, he was amazed to hear the story. He never knew that his father was so committed and had such self-sacrifice to actually risk his life. But he said, that's amazing. And no one should ever have to give up something that's so pleasurable to them and so important to them, like a Kiddush cup, because they explained to him the significance of it. So he's giving it back, and it made its way back to America. The end of the story, the cherry on the top of the story, is that this Mr. Winkler's grandson was about to get married. They used that cup under the chuppah. But that grandson, his name, he was named after Mr. Winkler's father, whose name was Michael Shalom. And the Kiddush cup said, Menashe Tzui Ben Michael Shalom. So the name was on the cup. So you got onto a bus. It was annoying. It was, why? Anyway, that's the story. I was going to tell you the story anyway. But I will link it back, because difficult conversations are good for us. These things about thinking about the blind spots and trying to create rituals that let go of our ego, they are very, very difficult, but they're good for us. So whenever we land up in a very tough situation needing to have a conversation which is very frustrating, we didn't get onto the wrong bus. It's the right bus. God is sending it to us. God sends it to us for a reason, for us to become better people. We'll continue on the conversation next week. Please God, have a wonderful week.